let's see, where are we? I would like to talk today about, well, in particular about using integral inequalities, and I'm going to use them, first of all, for decay rates, to discuss decay rates for the heat equation. Well, you can imagine that this section is really on the analysis of functions of a real variable, the natural function spaces, a little bit like function analysis, and the Fourier transform. But we're always using it somehow. Our applications are always focused on learning something about partial differential equations. So what I want to say is we had Young's inequality. Which I guess I'm going to remind you of. It says the following thing. I'm sorry for the leafing back and forth. It's a little more continuous than my own notes. which was theorem 2. And it went as follows. Let H be an L1 function, an Rn, and consider convolution with H an operator. I'm rephrasing what I said last time a little bit. An operator T sub H of F of X is equal to H convolved with F of X, which of course we all know is integral of H of X minus Y Fy dy integrate over Rn. And the question is T a bounded operator? And on what spaces? So Young's inequality says that for 1 less than or equal to P, less than or equal to plus infinity, I look at the result of TH of F, I measure it in LP space. And just to be repetitious, I'm saying I'm looking at H convolved with F, that's a new function of X, and I'm taking its LP norm. And the statement is that's bounded above by the L1 norm of H, the LP norm of F. And so if I do this small side calculation that says that the operator norm of TH from LP to LP, that's defined to be, you take the sup over all Fs in LP with LP norm equal to 1, that's one way to do it, of the L of the target norm, that is the LP norm again, of TH of F. That's the definition of the operator norm. And we see that is it's got to be the sup over F and LP. What's TH of F? Whatever it is, it's bounded by HL1 FLP. HL1 FLP. But of course, FLP is equal to 1, so I can replace this by 1. So it says the operator norm bound on a convolution with an L1 function is bounded by the L1 norm of convolution. Good. That's pretty straightforward. Sorry? Oh, supremum over F equals 1? Supremum, it's... Well, I just replace the supremum of that thing with something which is bigger. That always dominates. Right, it's the sup over all possible f, so it's the sup over all possible f of a bigger number each time.
Young inequality usually doesn't have to do with convolution function.
It has to do with convolution in this incarnation of Young's inequality. There are a lot of Young inequalities. There's some old inequality. Young's inequality is an old inequality. There's a lot of, not a very good joke. This is what we're calling Young's inequality. We're going to have another one soon. Okay? Who was Young? Where does he work? Madison. Died at a very old age, I can't remember when, was a thesis advisor of a number of people, including a number of well-known people, including Wendell Fleming. How about that? Young measures are from Young. Wendell Fleming. Young measures are from Young. Okay. Let me immediately say, what did we use this for? In the first case, we said that we wanted to solve the heat equation. Solve the heat equation. So, d by dt of u is equal to 1 half Laplacian u. U, when t is equal to 0, is equal to some data. And I'm going to give this in LP. And then we have a formula for u of xt. It's the heat operator operating on u0. That's a function of x, which is otherwise known as you take the heat kernel and you convolve with u0. And that's a function of x. And I want to know how big u can be. So let's look at it this way. How big is u of xt? Measured in LP. Well, by Young's inequality, it's no bigger than the L1 norm of the heat kernel itself times the LP norm of U0. And this is easy to compute because when you use the absolute values for computing an L1 function, you don't even need them because the kernel is already positive. So it's the integral of the heat kernel, which is 1. So this is equal to 1. We've just proved that the operator norm, the operator norm of the operator of heat flow, operator norm from LP to LP is less than or equal to 1. And now, it seems to me, there's a problem set problem. Was it official or was it just informal? Show it's equal to 1. Is that what you're handing in today? Equality? Question mark? The answer is surely yes. I just need a proof. That's what we did last time, and it's just a reminder of what you use, a way that inequalities among functions of this form are used, for example, in partial differential equations. So, we have a generalized version of Young's inequality, which I think I proved at the very end of last session. And that is generalized version. It's actually theorem. Easy to state. Just a sec. Theorem 4. Which is a generalized version of Young's inequality, which says, let me take 1 less than or equal to p, q, and r. I'm also allowed to go up to infinity, but I need them to satisfy a relationship which actually derived from dimensional analysis. So this way, we decided what the exponents were, and then we proved the theorem, if you remember that. The dimensional analysis says that 1 plus 1 upon r is equal to 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. So it says, let these indices be chosen such that that happens, then, not very good prose, I must say, but sorry about that, f convolved with h, when you measure it, not necessarily in LP, but how about in LR, is less than or equal to a constant times F LP times H and LQ. You might worry, suppose H isn't in LQ. If I give you an H which is not LQ, well, the right-hand side is infinite, so we can do anything on the left-hand side. So I don't even have to say that F and H are in LP and LQ, respectively. And we prove this by, to tell you the truth, the Hurwitz inequality, and a little bit of manipulation, just as we proved Young's inequality by the Hilbert inequality and a little bit of manipulation. And we chose the, if you forget those indices, what do? Dimensional analysis. I'm trying to brainwash you. Now, we're supposed to, whenever we see something like that, we're supposed to apply it to an equation. So here's the heat equation. Let's try it out. So what I'd like to say is we've now found that the heat operator is bounded on LP. Oh, it also reminds me, is the Schrodinger operator, the flow of the Schrodinger equation, bounded on LP? Question mark. Who has an answer? I have an answer. Yes, if P is 2. How about if P is not 2? It also reminds me that it's a problem set that's owing. The funny thing is that when the operator makes functions spread out or highly localized, that's bad for LP to LP boundedness. And the Schrodinger kernel, unfortunately, makes things spread out too much. So it's not. It's up to you to prove it. And to prove not, what do you need? A counterexample. And how are you going to find a counterexample? Wave packets. So look at how a wave packet behaves under LP spaces. However, it doesn't say that if I map from LP to LQ, the Schrodinger kernel is not bound. The Schrodinger operator is not bounded. In fact, it is for appropriate P and Q. So I'm going to prove that later. But let me use that as motivation to say that how does the heat operator behave between LP and LQ? And in fact, what I'll show is that the heat operator makes things decay if P and Q are chosen appropriately. It's a way of quantifying, in a rough sort of way, how the heat equation takes data which can be quite sharp and even quite rough and makes it smooth out and decay as time goes on. So let's do that. So again, heat flow given by U of XT is equal to convolution with the heat kernel. If I don't drink my coffee, I won't stay awake. I will stay awake, but I won't be happy. So excuse me. So let's see. And therefore, I can, just as I did in the left-hand blackboard, I can say that U of T as a function of X measured in LP space is bounded by H in L1. I'm just repeating. Sorry. Very repetitious. But you know what? Instead of using this, I'm going to switch the role of H and U around in the uses of the LP spaces. So how about U dot T LP is less than or equal to, in fact, I'm going to say this specific. How about L infinity? Why not L infinity? So U LP is less than or equal to H. But now I'm going to put the L infinity norm on H and the L1 norm on U naught. And now this is interesting. Let's try to compute the L infinity norm of H, of the kernel H. It just reverses. All I did was reverse which space. And so what I'm going to do is, what I'm in process of doing, the process is to estimate an operator norm. That is, this heat flow operator in the operator norm. But I start out in L1. My data is in L1, and it maps to L infinity. And how does that behave? It's a way of saying it. One way of saying it in notation. Okay, so let's look at H L infinity. And that's just applying Young's inequality. So let's do this. I'll just do it by hand. U T L infinity is less than or equal to h t l infinity u naught l1, which is less than or equal to, now what's the l infinity norm? It's the sup over x of the absolute value, but it's positive. I don't even need the absolute value. 1 upon root 2 pi t to the n e to the minus x squared upon 2t times u naught l1. And please just tell me what that sup is. Well, it's a sup over x, so what's the sup of that? 1. So this is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi t to the n u0 l1. I've now computed an upper bound for the operator norm bound. In fact, it's sharp. So that's interesting. What it says is, if I start out with L1 initial data, I mean, initial data for a heat equation means it's like a heat distribution. So I start out with a heat distribution with total heat 1, that is integral 1, L norm 1, 1, but it's usually its distribution is positive. So total heat 1. Then later on, what's the height of the heat at any particular point? Uniformly goes to 0 in T. Of course, it spreads out. You haven't lost any heat, but it's spread out, so this actual amplitude, the L infinity norm, is going down like 1 upon root t to the n. Dimensions in there. Okay, we can also quantify derivatives. Oh, something I wanted to say about this is pretty good for t going to infinity. It says it goes to 0. As t goes through positive numbers down to 0, what happens? What does it say? It says that u becomes less, is very possibly less and less bounded. Well, that's true. I can give initial data, which is perfectly good, L1 function, which is plenty unbounded, immediately is bounded, but for small times by a very big constant. Let's check that same phenomenon with derivatives. So I can quantify the behavior of derivatives. So let's try d by dx, the alpha of u of xt. And I guess we just use the expression for the solution of the heat equation, which is I have to take h of x minus y t u0 of y dy. And this is a very nicely convergent object for t positive. And so I can take all the x's inside, and the only x is here on the h. So I want to look at d by dx of h of x minus y t. And I want to quantify its size. Now, who's taken lots of derivatives of the heat kernel before? If you take alpha many derivatives, it starts what it does is it returns you Hermite functions, which are Hermite polynomials times Gaussians. So in any case, you can just imagine, you don't start out with any polynomials, but as soon as you take x derivatives, you start getting things out of the exponent, and they start coming down on the ground where they also get differentiated. And you do that alpha many times, where alpha, of course, is a multi-index. So we're going to get an expression, something of the following form. This I'm going to say is some Hermite function. I'll call it h in honor of that, but its nature, actually, we don't really need to know too much, other than it's a function of x minus y over root t. But you can see if you differentiate once with respect to x, I'm going to get a 2x over 2t. So it's x over root t times an extra root t. So outside I have a 1, and if you do that by induction, you have an extra 1 over t to the alpha power. That's its homogeneity. And of course you're differentiating the Gaussian, so I haven't put the Gaussian in yet. E to the minus x squared over, x minus y squared over 2t, then I have to normalize 2 pi t to the n, and what have I forgotten? Only the u naught of y dy. In any case, that's what happens when you take a lot of derivatives. So I want to now measure how big dx alpha u of xt is. And let me just measure it, say, because I've been measuring in L infinity, let's just measure it in L infinity. How big can that be later on? Well, it's less than using this philosophy and this philosophy of switching the role of L infinity in L1 norm, it's less than or equal to the supremum over x of some absolute value now, of some quantity. And that's h alpha of x over root t times this extra factor, 1 upon root t to the alpha, times e to the minus x squared over 2t over root 2 pi t to the n. I'm just copying this down with absolute value signs around it, right? It's soup of all this thing. Times, what is it, u naught in L1. Just using the same estimate. And question it. Question, how big is that? Well, here is a function of x over root t, which decays very rapidly. So it's a function of, say, w, where w is equal to x over root t. And here is a function x over root t, which grows as much as a polynomial in mod alpha, but not further. So this times this, as you change w, it's just bounded by some constant. So putting all the other extraneous constants in together is a constant that depends on alpha and n. And what's left in the denominator? T, powers of t. So root t to the n plus alpha. Isn't that right? Times u naught L1. That's an L infinity L1 bound on the heat kernel, on heat flow. What does it say? The decay rate is faster. So if I put in, so I look at the oscillations of the solution at later time, they get smaller faster than actual size of the solution. Isn't that interesting? In this, well, pretty precisely quantified way. Does that seem reasonable? What does the heat equation do to something very oscillatory? Suppresses it. The more oscillatory, the more fast it's suppressed. That's consistent with this. It quantifies it a bit. Okay, we can see that just looking at the Fourier transform, for example, of the heat kernel. It's not good for small times, because, of course, I'm not starting out with any derivatives. And here I'm taking 8 gazillion derivatives. So can I bound my derivatives after 1 microsecond? Given my initial data, which I only say is some density, but possibly not bounded, I can. The bound is not very good. It has something to do with this constant, which is c to the 1 gazillion, depending on n, and this constant, which is at 1 microsecond to this power, which is pretty big, but still finite. So good. For a more flexible result, this is only Young. I've only used Young. Now let's use generalized Young. And let's see what we have. Let's just copying it out. It says, here it is. I'm going to use it in terms of the heat kernel. So u at time t, I'm going to measure it in LR. And that's equal to h at time t convolution with u naught LR. And I want to use generalized Young, which says I bound this above by h LT times u naught LQ. Isn't that what it says? And then I have to balance things. Remember dimensional scaling, 1 plus 1 upon r is equal to 1 upon p plus 1 upon q. And if I do that, it says that this is going to be less than or equal to a constant, which is going to depend on n, and it's also going to depend on q. And of course, I guess it depends on P, Q, and R. But there's one relation, so it depends on P and Q, and how do I write this? I'll put them all down just to be, you know, it depends on P, Q, R, and N, but there's one relation among P, Q, and R. But I don't know which one to favor, so we'll put them all down. P, Q, and R, satisfying this relation. And there'll also be a factor of T. There'll also be a factor of T. Semicolon T, I'm going to quantify that for this in a second. U naught LQ. That's what we're going to prove. Let's quantify what that constant is and how it depends on T. Because in some sense, that's our business at the present time. Let's try it out. So what we need to do, of course, is figure out what this LP norm of the heat kernel is. Q norm of the heat kernel. Let's try it out. So let's see if we get a reasonable estimate for the LQ norm of the heat kernel. So we take it at time t, and we look at its LQ norm. It's always easier to not take the qth root yet. So we'll do the qth root in a second. Everyone with me? Oh, damn. Excuse me. P. Why did I change notation? Because P and P and Q, I should have done in the other order, sorry. But my notes have Q, so then I'll get confused if I don't write Q. So if you save me, bye. Okay? So I need the Q norm of H. Now I need the Q norm of H. Something's still not right. I need the Q norm of H. Well, let's take the Q's power and just integrate. So there's this normalization factor, 1 upon 2 pi root 2 pi t to the n, and we took it to the Q's power. That's what you do when you take the Q's power of the integral. And then you integrate. Something is positive, so I don't even have to put absolute value signs. But inside, we get e to the minus x squared upon 2t to the qth power dx. And can anyone do this in their head? It's equal to, I did it in my head last night, and I'm just going to copy. 2 pi t to the n, q minus 1 times 1 upon root q to the nth power. That's what it is. You can see it because there's a natural variable. X prime is equal to x root q. And so if you change variables, you get rid of the q, and that gives you this factor. And then the integral gives you an extra root 2 pi t to the n. That's the minus 1. And let's take its qth root. So let me do it this way. This constant I've now quantified. So that's equal to, there's always the u0lp on the outside. And now let's quantify that constant. It is 1 upon root 2 pi t to the n. Well, now I take the qth root of this, because that's the qth power. So I have 1 minus 1 upon q. And then I have a root, I need a little more space. And then I have also in the denominator, root q to the n, but I need the qth root, n over q. And then I have the u naught LP norm. That's a constant which will bound it by generalized Young. Very often in the literature, this exponent is replaced through this relationship. 1 minus 1 upon Q is equal to 1 upon P minus 1 upon R. So 1 upon P minus 1 upon R. You're welcome to replace it there if you want. Good. Very nice. How? Let's consider derivatives. Because we can do derivatives too. So let's consider derivatives. So I have to do this thing. D by dx, that's the same exercise. D by dx, the alpha u, and I'm looking at it in LR norm. It's going to be less than or equal to d by dx to the alpha, the heat kernel, L, better be consistent, LQ, U naught, LP. And we calculate, and so what we have to do is calculate how big is this. That's all we have to do. So we have to calculate, just to get the estimate right, how big that thing is, d by dx d alpha, h, l, q, we found it healthy to take the q's power, so we don't have to do too much. Well, let's see, there's always this factor, 2 pi t to the n q minus 1, there's a 1 upon, I think you need a back of the envelope for this, t to the alpha q's power. I'm serious. In fact, last night, I took an envelope out of my bin because I didn't want to waste any more paper and calculated it on the back of the envelope just to make sure that we did it in traditional style. Integral of absolute value of h alpha, x over root t, to the q's power, e to the minus x squared q over 2t, dx. And you have to do this integral. And you find it is equal to, well, some constant that depends on Q and R. I guess it depends on PQR, just as before. PQR with one relation. Depends on the N and depends on alpha. Over how many powers of T? Root T to the N. 1 minus 1 upon Q plus alpha. Same phenomena. Whole thing to the q's power, that defines the constant because I'm going to take the q's root and put it in here to bound the estimate. So the time behavior, and then in any case, the time behavior, so the temporal behavior. Is basically t, root t to the minus n times 1 minus 1 upon q is 1 over p minus 1 upon r plus alpha. Times a constant. What does that mean? The more derivatives you take, when you're estimating this way, the more derivatives you take, the better it decays later on, but the worse it is as you try to approach your initial data. Clearly, because your initial data doesn't have derivatives, so you don't want its limit as t goes to zero to be a bounded operator. And in fact, if you found that, you'll be punished. Interesting estimate. LP, LQ, LR estimate, right? And so we are calculating, so these are estimates of the heat operator, the heat flow operator, an operator norm. We start out with data in LP, and we end up with data in LR. And this gives an estimate for it. And in order to do that, we estimate some heat kernel in LQ. Okay, interesting. I want to move on to other properties of convolution. Not too many. I mean, we could probably spend the whole course talking about convolution. But this is not the ultimate statement of a convolution operator. It's really just a very crude statement. It's easy, uses Hurwitz inequality, but it's pretty crude. And I want to show you how one can do, well, a bit better by just a little bit further consideration. So I'm going to do that, well, a series of theorems that are really kind of classical real analysis theorems. I'm just using them here because it's interesting and relevant. So theorem 5. Let's have 1 less than or equal to p. It also is allowed to be infinity. And, whoops, consider a function h of x and lp of rn. And I'm going to look at its result when it's convolved with f and lp prime. So then, for f of x in lp prime of rn, remember, 1 upon p plus 1 upon p prime is equal to 1. That's so important. But of course, I don't have a funny notation for p, q, and r, although maybe we should. Actually, some people in the room, in fact, a particular person has given me a much better notation where it's additive in the ratios of 1 upon p's. But I think the traditional will just make me confused. So we can have a guest lecture on the improved LPLQ notation if you want. But I'm going to stick with this. So for f in LP prime, I look at the convolution. I take h and I convolve with f, and that's a function of x. Now, p plus p prime is equal to 1, so by Young's inequality, I'm allowed r to be infinity. Because this adds up to 1, so the r better be infinity to cancel this. So r is infinity. So this implies r is equal to infinity in Young. So that says that's bounded. But this theorem says it's better. So I want to say that this says it's in continuous functions on Rn. More than bounded, it's continuous. So Young's inequality says it's LP. Let me make an explicit note. Young's inequality implies HF is in L infinity in this case. But we can do better. So among other things, it's a good idea to think further. But Young is still good, but it's a good idea to think further. Okay, it's a classic, so this is a proof, classic real analysis statement, and it's based on another classic real analysis fact, which is translation in an LP space is continuous. So classic fact, classical fact, translation in LP is continuous, is a continuous operation, meaning the following thing, that if I take a function h, and I x plus a small increment k, and I minus h at x, and I take the LP norm of this, and then I take the limit as k goes, that small increment, k goes to 0. K, of course, is allowed to be anything in Rn, right? But I think the limit as k goes to 0, this is equal to 0. Now I have a question for you. Which p's are allowed? Just say that again. Only finite p's. P not equal to infinity. Thanks. And that says LP is a continuous operator, 1 less than or equal to p, less than plus infinity. Let's just think about that for a minute. LP of Rn is a separable space, except L infinity of Rn is a non-separable space. If I take a step function, any function with a jump, take a step function in L infinity, and I translate it. Any difference between a step function and any of its translates, no matter what k is, the difference is 1. So the limit of this would always be 1. So It's specifically not L infinity. It's not just there isn't a proof. It is not in L infinity, in plus infinity. Okay, good. Good. Let's look at the theorem. I'm allowing any p, but the conjugate variables. So suppose p is infinity. Switch h and f. So without loss of generality, p is finite. Okay? Now let's estimate. Now let's look at the convolution. So I want to look at the convolution of h and f at a point x plus k, but I want to look at that h convolved with f at the point x, and I want to look at the difference. And I want to see how the difference behaves when I put the absolute value on it. What is the difference between these two numbers at a particular point x? Well, bad for notes, even before I put on the absolute value, I just want to express this in terms of the convolution. So it's integral of h of x plus k minus y, that's going to be the convolution here, minus the integral of h of x minus y, that's the convolution here, always convolved with f of y dy. And now I'll put the absolute values in. And now I have p and p prime with p finite. So I use Young with r equal to infinity. The sup of this over x, or the essential sup of this over x, is less than or equal to this kernel, which is h of x plus k minus h of x, and lp, p is the finite one, times f l q, p prime. And then we have this fact, which says that the right-hand side goes to 0 as k goes to 0, which says that as k approaches x, this approaches that, which is continuity. So we're done. But we've proved more, because this is an estimate which is independent of x. Look, I've just integrated over x's to do that. So I can even say more, uniform continuity, uniformly continuous. That's what you get from convolution operators. Okay, let's move on. Let's actually work under here. Now let's just, I want to make a small remark. It is a classic exam problem in real analysis. Maybe it's given on people's orals, which is cute, and we're right at the point of proving it. So let me just state it. So classical real analysis question. It goes as follows. Let A and B be measurable sets of Rn with positive measure. Both have positive measure. Form the sum. How do you form a sum of sets? A plus B, the sum of sets is all x in Rn, where x is in the form of y plus z with y in A and z in B. And the statement is A plus B contains an open set. Isn't that interesting? So I can take two positive measure Cantor sets and take their sum. It has to contain an open set.
Can you make a union?
It's not a union. It's a sum. You take a union of B's. You could say it's a union. So this is a union over all Y in A of B plus Y. So you take B and then add, take a Y in A, translate B and add, and you take a union, translate B. So it's a union of two. It's a, what do you say? It's an uncountable union of A's and the translates. Or it's symmetric, so, right, some of it. Isn't that interesting? How would you prove it given the information on the board? Ah, that's a good thing to ask. Think of it as your oral exam, and somebody asks you that. That's right. The faculty member is not allowed to reply. I didn't put it in my notes, but I will put it in my notes. Well, what does it have to do with convolution? Well, it has something to do with... So I'd say the following. It's the same if you just subtract A and B, right? Oh, I have to put this in the right. Y minus B. It's the same question with A minus B. And then, so A minus B equals the support of a convolution. If you take the characteristic function of A convolve with the characteristic function of B. And now I want to say that A characteristic function of A is in LP, and the characteristic function of B is in LP prime. In fact, they're in all LPs. It's just a, oh, make a finite set. Without loss of generality, make A and B finite measure. Otherwise, take a finite measure piece of them, and it only gets bigger when you add in the rest. So make A and B finite measure. And look at their convolution. This is the support of a continuous function. And that continuous function can't be identically zero because both measures are positive. But as soon as the continuous function is positive somewhere, it's got to be positive in a neighborhood of that because that's an open condition. So contains an open set. Interesting. Very interesting. Maybe a more stronger result and more apropos is let me not paint myself into a corner. I'll go over here. That convolution product inherits the regularity properties of a of the elements in its kernel. So let me say that, and I just did that with the heat equation, but I'm just going to make it a principle of it. So so let me say it this way. A regular function h of x will bestow its, I'll even say it this, all of its regularity properties on the convolution product. So to quantify that, to make it actually a precise statement, let's just say the theorem. So theorem 6, which is, well, let's not fool around with details. Let's just take H as Schwarz class. Smooth and rapid decaying. And And let's not make F too general, like maybe not too distributional. Let's just make F an LP. LP of Rn. 1 less than or equal to P, less than or equal to infinity. We don't mind. Then, H of F, the convolution product, H convolve with F of X is what? It's C infinity. Question, is it Schwarz class? Better make that remark. I didn't think about it when I was writing my notes, but it's a good thing to ask. So, remark. H convolved with F will not necessarily be Schwarz class. Well, let's do the ridiculous case. Suppose it's an L infinity function. Convolve an L infinity function with a little bump, a nice smooth bump, and the result has support everywhere. It's just nice and smooth. Well, now let's go into LP. Take an LP function which decays, but not very fast. Then you make it smooth it out with a nice smooth bump. It decays, but not very fast, but it happens to be smooth, too. So you don't gain decay properties, but you do gain regularity properties. Good. Just wanted to check. And the proof is clearly differentiate. A friend of mine said, if it moves, differentiate it. So differentiate. So z by dx to the alpha of convolution product. Of course, I needn't remind you, but I will anyway. It's z by dx to the alpha, integral of h of x minus y fy dy. And what's moving in the integral? Only the x. Everything else is integrated out. So, and h is Schwarz class enough, so we can pass through the derivative through the integral sign without incurring the wrath of the gods. And this remains Schwarz class. In particular, it remains in LP prime when H is F is in LP. And so you can take as many as derivatives as you want, and you haven't changed its LP space. So the derivatives of the thing remain in the same LP space. So that says that H F dx alpha, in particular, H F dx is in the same LP space as F. How about that? Good. Many pages. So we're moving very, very well. I want to move on to the subject of elementary estimates of the Fourier transform. Haven't seen the Fourier transform here yet. And you also remarked that I've always wanted to contrast the heat kernel, the heat flow and the Schrodinger flow. And I've only talked about heat flow, so I have to get to Schrodinger flow. But it's break time, so I thought we'd have a short break. But also, just let me check the red card, green card question. You're not giving me a yellow card, are you? Is it too fast, too slow, just right? Impossible. Infinite, L infinity. What is it? It's both too slow and too fast. Okay. It is no comment, it appears. I'll then do what I want. If you want me to do something else, let me know. Let's see. What's our plan for the continuing class meetings? We're meeting on the 10th. Are we meeting on the 17th? Not on the 24th? Not on the 31st? What's the next one? I think not on the first week of January or something. I think we're not, I think the first January date, we're also not meeting. I better be precise about our next meeting time. February? No. Second week of January, I think it will be. But I do have to check my schedule because it just got unfortunately a little complicated. I wasn't planning. It's one of these things which once everyone gets fixed into, you have to have the agreement of everybody in the room. I don't want to start a riot or anything. So unless you start a riot and it has to be another day, actually I'm ready to accommodate, but before you come with a proposition, make sure everyone else has agreed. Then you can do the negotiation. Let's stick with Wednesday, if that's okay. Same time in the morning, seem all right. More or less people from the distant suburbs like Hamilton can make it here with a little bit of luck with the traffic. I don't think I've been late quite yet, at least not for traffic reasons. Okay, let's go on. I want to talk about elementary estimates for the Fourier transform. So let's see, we know one basic, I'm sort of putting derivatives and LPs and LQs together into the Fourier transform. And so we have one basic one, so the basic equality, and we use it over and over again, is the Poincaré identity. Which is to say that if I take f and I take its Fourier transform and I measure it in L2, it's equal to if I didn't take the Fourier transform. And there are many ways of seeing that, including Fourier transform is a unitary operator on L2. But there are also alternatives. That is, we might want to look at the Fourier transform and see how it maps between Banach spaces. Does it take an LP space, and does it preserve that LP space? Who knows the answer? If I take an LP function, and I take its Fourier transform, is it an LP? Sorry? If P is 2, that works. If P is not 2, it might be P prime, but not for all functions will it be in P again. For a lot, like for Schwarz class function, it surely will be. It's in all LPs and stays there, but not every function. So good. So let's address that, and I have a proposition, which I think we're already up to 7 today, is for F in L1, where is the Fourier transform? Then F hat of C is in L infinity. Is bounded by a constant f in L1. So you could say the operator norm of the Fourier transform operator from L1 to L infinity is bounded or less than or equal to that constant c. Well, it's simple, so it's always good to do simple things. So let's try that, which is by definition, f hat of c is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the I c dot x f of x dx. I'm afraid that's not right. It's minus. But immaterial if we take the absolute value. And now the absolute value on the outside, I'm going to pull it to the inside. Absolute value of e to the minus I c dot x f of x dx. Absolute value of a complex exponential, of course, is 1, and it leaves us with 1 upon root 2 pi to the n. F L1 norm, just like that. So I identify the constant with 1 upon 2 pi to the n. Oh, you can put any constant you want, as long as it's true, but one possible constant, the one that I was intending, really, is 1 upon 2 pi to the n. Good. More is true of the Fourier transform. So another property, which is, again, you learn in real analysis. So another property which I'm going to bring to the Fourier transform, which you learn in real analysis, is, it's exhibited by an example. But I'm worked into a corner, so I'm going to put my example on a new board. So another property. I'm going to illustrate this by an example. As I said, let's take f of x equal to the characteristic function of a rectangle. So what's a rectangle? Well, it's all those x's such that x1 lies between a1 and b1. Open rectangle, closed, I guess it doesn't matter. b1. xj lies between aj and bj, etc., up to xn. That's a rectangle. And let's take its Fourier transform, f hat of c. Well, the characteristic function is then a product of characteristic functions of these intervals. So f hat is going to be a product of Fourier transforms of the characteristic functions of the individual one-dimensional integral. So it's sum j equals, product j equals 1 to n of 1 upon root 2 pi to the 1 power, because it's a one-dimensional Fourier transform. Integral from aj to bj, e to the, I made a sign mistake in my notes, minus I cj, the jth coefficient, xj, the jth coefficient, dxj, which is equal to, we'll call it 1 of the 2 pi to the n, pull them all out, product j equals 1 to n. Let's see, there's a minus sign here, so it's e to the I minus I cj b minus e to the minus I cj aj, bj aj, divided by minus I cj. And what does that function look like? Well, a bunch of things of size 1 in the numerator and 1 upon cj in the denominator. And you multiply them. So this decays like see, what does it decay like? Well, away from the coordinate axis, I'm a little stuck on the coordinate axes. But it decays like 1 over a... I'll just say 1 over product of cj, product of j, so it decays. I got a little stuck in the because of the coordinate axes. But in any case, the one-dimensional integrals decay as c gets large. And as long as you stay away from any individual coordinate plane, the whole thing decays as c gets large. So in any case, there's decay at infinity, which is the famous Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Or it supports the idea of the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. In fact, I'm a little worried about the coordinate plane, so let's not discuss. I should have done the one-dimensional example where I wouldn't have that in place. But sorry? You want me to put that in the denominator? Doesn't look like this then. But this is exact. That's true. There we go. Let's let the analysis be done in the back of the class. C to the minus n. There we go. Now I'm out of trouble. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It decays. And so lemma 8 is the following statement. It's the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Which says the Fourier transform of F in L1 decays to zero as C goes to infinity. And here's the proof. Well, the proof is real analysis. But let's do a proof sketch. Just to have the fun of having this as part of our knowledge base. That goes as follows. Step one, approximate F in L1 by simple functions. Everyone remember what a simple function is? It's one which takes on finitely many different values on finitely many different measurable sets, all of finite measure, and then is zero everywhere else. So it's a sum of constant sum characteristic functions of measurable sets. That's simple, finite number, finite sum. Okay, and that can be done by, that's general Lebesgue theory. Then approximate each of the simple functions by step functions. And that is Lucene's theorem. It's like Littlewood's three principles. One of Littlewood's three principles, that every measurable set is almost a finite union of rectangles. Almost. Okay, and then study the Fourier transform of a step function. Which is what we just did. Well, the step function is a finite linear sum of characteristic functions of rectangles. We've just done one. And we did this. And then we're done. Well, we're done at least with the sketch. So let's go back to proposition 7 and say, well, we know a little bit more about the Fourier transform of an L1 function. It's not just bounded. What does it do? It goes to zero at C goes to infinity. That's a closed subspace of L infinity, isn't it? The functions which go to zero. Is there a rate implied? Nope. Can't say it's going to go faster than C to the minus 10 or anything. A rate is not implied, but goes to zero. Next step. Under translation, the Fourier transform. Why do I say under translation? Let me restart the sentence. For F in L1, the Fourier transform F hat of C is continuous, furthermore, uniformly continuous. Let's just check, and it's going to look a little bit like our previous check when we studied convolution for some reason. So let's try it. F hat of C plus, forgive me, I'm going to call the increment on the Fourier side still K. In fact, maybe it's better K on the Fourier side. Minus F hat of C, it's equal to 1 upon root 2, it's equal to the nuisance factor times the integral e to the I, now e to the I c plus k dot x minus e to the I c x. So it's e to the I minus I c x times e to the minus I c dot, sorry, k dot x minus 1 times f of x dx. Take the absolute value. And I can say that that's bounded by 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral. Absolute value inside just has absolute value of e to the minus I k dot x minus 1 f of x dx integral over Rn. And this integral converges to 0 as k goes to 0, doesn't it? So my question is why? Sorry? Well, I think you need cancellation for Riemann-Lebesgue, and I've already put absolute values on everything in sight, so not so good. Well, what would you do if you were in my position and I had to show you? F is in L1, I agree, so the integrand is absolutely integrable. Is that what you said? Absolute continuity. Well, let's just think about the integrand. They're probably all very good suggestions, but at least this is the way I thought about it. This goes to 1 for each x. As I take k goes to 0, this goes to 1, so this gets small. Does it do it uniformly in x? That's the only problem. For a fixed k, I can make x big and make this thing oscillate. So for fixed k, this minus 1 is as big as 2. It doesn't have to go to 0. So how am I ever going to get this to go to 0? And the answer is, if I take k really small, you have to make x really large in order to make it go around the circle. And if x is really large, f being L1 is already small. So cut this integral into 2, where the integral of f already is less than epsilon upon 2, where epsilon is that thing that I'm supposed to get less than in order to show I'm going to 0. And then the other part of the integral, I have this on a bounded set. Oh, when I do that, that's on a bounded set, outside a big ball of radius r. inside a ball of radius r, I make sure that k is small enough so this is less than epsilon on, upon 2 divided by the norm of f, Elman norm of f, so that this takes the rest to epsilon over 2. Done. We're done, aren't we? Good. I'm glad we're moving fast. These three facts together, three facts. Boundedness, L infinity to O1, Riemann-Lebesgue, and uniform continuity. We've now proved the following theorem, which is our theorem 9, actually, which is for F in L1 of Rn, the Fourier transform, F hat of C is in, well, it's bounded, it's continuous, and it goes to zero at infinity. So I don't know how to say that, but maybe we'll say it's a continuous function R on Rn. That's already bounded continuous, and I guess D for decreasing. Not zero, because we use that for compact support. It's not at all necessarily compact support. D for decreasing. So this is space of bounded continuous functions on R and which decay to zero as xc goes to infinity. Good, very good. Nothing. Not in this case. Give me a rate, I can make it slower. Absolutely. Nothing we can do. And I just want to say again, CDRN is a closed subspace of C. It's a closed space of the space of continuous functions. Now, back to LP. The Fourier transform doesn't behave particularly well on LP. That is, there's no real analog for P, P not equal to. There's no real analog of, unfortunately, of the Poincaré theorem. But we could ask, how does F map LPs to LQs? And that was already mentioned in class when I was saying, let's study that fact. And that's theorem 10, which is often called the Hausdorff-Young. Inequality. Hausdorff, I guess, was a professor at Bonn. And if you go out of the university area to the southeast, you go along a broad avenue called Hausdorff Avenue. How about that? So let's see. Well, I want to say the following thing. When 1 less than or equal to p, I want p less than or equal to p prime, less than or equal to plus infinity, and, of course, p prime has to be the conjugate, so 1 over p plus 1 over p prime equals 1, then how big, in what LP space is the Fourier transform? And what it says is it's at least an LP prime. And here's a place, when I talked about Young's first inequality, I said, oh, it is a common, I did it for L1, L infinity, I did it for L2, L2. No, I did it for L1, L1, I did it for L1, L infinity. And then I said, you can do the rest by Riesz-Thorin interpolation. But you can also do the rest just by simple estimates. But here's a place where it's kind of convenient to do Riesz-Thorin interpolation. So I'd like to use this as an excuse to introduce Riesz-Thorin interpolation inequality. And I'm going to introduce it using the following notation. So, let's see. And I guess I'm going to do it just putting it in as a theorem. And the notation will be brought along as I state the theorem. So this is Riesz-Thorne interpolation. So we're going to give a bunch of indices, four to tell you the truth. So take indices, a P1, but also a P2, and Q1, but also a Q2. I need all of them in the P1, P2, Q1, Q2. I all need them all in that range, means we're allowed to consider all possibilities, including the endpoints 1 and infinity. And consider a linear transformation I'll say it in the following way, T. And suppose it just takes Schwarz class to Schwarz class, and I want to know, does it extend to LP spaces? But I'm also going to say that this on Schwarz functions obeys certain LP rules. So such that, I want this to behave like this, such that, and which LP estimates do I want it to obey? T on U, LP1 is less than or equal to constant C1, U, L, Q1. And T, U, L, P2 less than or equal to C2, U, L, Q2. Then Messrs. Riesz and Thorne assert the following, that in fact you can find middle ground LP inequalities between P1, Q1, and P2, Q2, where it's also true. So the statement is then, for all 0 less than or equal to tau less than or equal to 1, I'm going to make a convex combination, appropriate convex combination of things, and all U, which is in the space U L Q tau of Rn, with, let's see, I want 1 upon Q tau to be equal to tau over Q1 plus 1 minus tau over Q2, and I'm also going to say something about P, so 1 upon P tau is equal to tau over P1 plus 1 minus tau over P2. The interpolation estimate holds. The following thing. How big can TU become if I measure it in LP tau? It cannot be bigger than a constant times U measured in LQ tau. And that constant even is part of the information. And it is, well, a sufficient constant, maybe not the best in all cases, is C1 to the tau, C2 to the 1 minus tau. That's it. There are clever ways to prove this using complex analysis, where the complex number is actually P. But I'm not going to do this. Proof I'm going to leave to your imagination, or maybe to your own researches, because I'm getting too distracted and it's already 12:15. But it's an interesting interpolation inequality. So what I'll do is I'd like to use this, and I wanted to use it in a couple of places, including proof of Hausdorff-Young. Complex analysis proof. Good question. It uses a three-line lemma. Let me think where you might find that. Is it in Reed and Simon, the three-line, the use of it in the three-line lemma? Sorry?
It's in Folland.
It's in Folland. Good. It's also in Folland then. So, but let's use it. So use this. Let's use this information. And let's do it in the following way. So when we're going to have to prove Theorem 10, so I'm going to use it for Theorem 10. So I'm going to do the following choices. I want P1 equal infinity. And I want Q1 has to be the dual, so it's going to be 1. And P2 equals Q2, and I also want to be Q2. It's dual. I'm going to make that choice. And then let's see what we have. We have the Fourier transform. So if P1, let's see, so the two estimates are, we have F hat, which one's on the left? P's? So F hat infinity is less than or equal to 1 upon root 2 pi N F L1. That's my first statement, where C1 is 1 upon root 2 pi to the N. And I have F hat L2 is less than or equal to, in fact, it's equal to F L2. And that's my second one, with C2 equals 1. And then let's check the P's. So 1 upon P tau is equal to tau over infinity. Okay, that makes sense. Plus 1 minus tau over 2 is equal to 1 half times 1 minus tau. In particular, it's less than 1. Less than or equal to, no, 2. No, it's less than. Less than or equal to 1 half. That's what I want. And then 1 upon Q tau is equal to tau over, same thing, tau over 1 this time, plus 1 minus tau over 2 is equal to 1 half of 1 plus tau. We're supposed to add them and get 1. So I guess we add them and we get half plus a half, and the tau's cancel. So that's good. But this is 1 plus tau is greater than or equal to 1 half. So it's between 1 half and 1. Right, this is between 0 and 1 half, so P is between 2 and infinity, and this is between 1 half and 1, so Q is between 1 and 2. Right? So 2 less than or equal to P tau less than or equal to infinity, and 1 less than or equal to Q tau less than or equal to 2. That's what we found. Okay? And then, whoops, extraneous page, I want to come back to that. And we checked that 1 over P plus 1 over Q is equal to 1. So, of course, Q tau is equal to P tau prime. So we just checked that. And then we say, okay, if we have the two extremes, then we can put it in the middle. So that says the Fourier transform of F studied in LP prime space, that's the Q, is less than or equal to a constant, which is 2 pi to the n, 1 over p prime minus 1 over p, f in LP, as long as 2 less than or equal to p less than or equal to plus infinity. That's the P, and Q is equal to P prime. 1 is less than or equal to P prime, less than or equal to 2. So just check the restore and interpolation for those two inequalities we've already had, and we find LP estimates. Now I have two things I want to do and 10 minutes in order to do them, which is our usual difficulty. So I'm going to make a choice, and what I'd like to do is so much talk about the heat equation. There's no challenge there. Let's talk about the Schrodinger equation. So my question is, does the solution of the Schrodinger equation decay? Oh, is the solution of the Schrodinger equation bounded from an LP to LP? We decided no, unless P is equal to 2. How about from LT to LQ? Maybe. Which P, which Q? So let's discuss that. And we'll get a time decay estimate as well. So we're going to now study the flow of the Schrodinger equation. Meaning, I want to look at u of x t is equal to this. I decided it starts looking like a dollar sign. I'm not sure that's good or bad. Involved with u0 of x, which means to say that u is given by 1 upon root 2 pi I, the n e to the I, x minus y squared upon 2 t u0 of y dy, integral over Rn. And now let's follow the same reasoning. How big is ST? I guess this is S. This is the Schrodinger kernel. I meant to say this is S, and this is the Schrodinger operator, the Schrodinger flow, ST operating on u zero, a function of x. Sorry about the funny notation, which is equal to that. So how big is this flow operating on u naught? And if we do it in L2, so here's one tick, this is going to be one endpoint of a Riesz-Thorne interpolation. We decided this was unitary flow, so this is equal to u naught L2. Equal. Before, when we used Riesz-Thorne, it was taking the Fourier transform. Now it's flowing by the Schrodinger equation. Sometimes they're remarkably similar. Okay, so ST U naught is equal to U naught, an L2 norm. What else do we know? How about if I measure ST U naught, but in L infinity? Why not? Well, let's see. Using our, we're trying to get the endpoints, so we have to decide what technique are we going to use. But of course, if we say U naught were in L1, then we can use Young's inequality with L infinity on the Schrodinger kernel and L1. So, I mean, let me do that. Is equal to the Schrodinger kernel in L infinity U0 in L1. That would work, wouldn't it? Of course, if anything works, we just might get infinity. But here, in this case, we're going to get something reasonable. So it's going to be the sup over x and Rn of, what is it, 1 upon root absolute value, 1 upon root 2 pi I t to the nth power, e to the I, x squared upon 2 t. Sorry? Sorry? I missed the t. Thanks. 2 pi I t to the n, that's an n, not an r. Close. U naught. No, what? Sorry? Thanks. And what's the size of that? same thing, 1 over root t to the nth power. So this is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi t to the n, u0 l1. So let's now do our interpolation estimate. So those are the two basics. And it says the following thing, that if I happen to have an integrable data for the Schrodinger equation, not square integrable, that's what quantum mechanics would more or less dictate, but let's suppose we happen to have integrable as well, then when we measure the size of the solution later on, it's going down in absolute value at that rate, which looks like the rate of the heat equation. Now, apply Riesz-Thorin. With almost the same parameters as before, and what we're going to get is that u of t in LP, now let's just have a look. Don't we have up here L infinity L1, L2 L2, even the same constant, except if I put in the t, every time I see a 2 pi t, that's the constant. So same choice of indices there. I don't even have to redo it. How can I say? By induction. No, we've already done the algebra, so we just get to write it down because we're in the same situation. And it says it's less than or equal to, let me leave enough room, less than or equal to 1 upon root 2 pi t to the n, and what did he get? His 1 upon p prime minus 1 upon p. 1 over p minus 1 over p prime. I put the minus sign in a funny place there. U naught in L p prime. The tau is irrelevant now. But I do need 2 less than or equal to p less than or equal to plus infinity, and therefore 1 less than or equal to p prime less than or equal to 2. Isn't that interesting? So that's the Schrodinger's equation. Shall we try to continue the analogy with the heat equation? Let me take derivatives. How fast do derivatives decay for the Schrodinger equation? So let me say that again. My question. How about derivatives? So instinctively, for me, I put in a highly sort. It's to do with how does the equation treat oscillatory behavior. So if I put in a highly oscillatory behavior to the heat equation, there's heat, hot spaces near cold spaces, right close to cold spaces, and the diffusion, they average out. So the oscillations go down rapidly. So if I try to test how oscillatory it is, that is, I take an LP norm of a derivative or a bunch of derivatives, that decays more rapidly because those diffusing out of the oscillations happens fast. What do I do? But the lesson for the Schrodinger equation is different. What happens if I put in oscillatory behavior in data for the Schrodinger equation? Does it get suppressed? What happens to it? It propagates. I put in a bump with oscillatory behavior, zoom. If I get a very oscillatory, it goes somewhere. Does it decay? Not particularly. So do you think I'm able to take derivatives and bound them in terms of the initial data and get a finite answer? The answer is no way. So what about derivatives? Let's think that, quantify that. I'm going to take a soup. If I did it like the heat equation, I would come here, I would take a soup of something with a Hermite function here, and that would be bounded because this is a dying exponential. And now for the Schrodinger equation, I'm going to take d by dx to the alpha of 1 upon root 2 pi I t to the n e to the I x squared over 2t, and I'm going to bring down a Hermite function, like maybe some time variables, but a Hermite function, which is a polynomial in x over root t. And is that going to be bounded by something which is decaying exponential? No, this is going to be a growing factor. It's going to be an unbounded operator. And so I try to take the L infinity norm, and automatically this constant is infinity. So the complicated answer is probably a long discussion of how derivatives are treated in Witt-Sobolev space, but the simple answer is no. Not like the heat equation. It's more complicated. And it's because it's a wave equation. It propagates oscillation. Well, it's 12:30. For once, I'll stop not too many minutes in not too many minutes after the end of class. Let me stop here. I'll turn on the microphone. It's always a relief to turn the microphone off.